Stella Barone McGillivray. Chapter 28. The following morning, I'm staring at my reflection in the bathroom mirror when my dad dangles a set of keys in front of my eyes. "No thanks," I say. "No choice. Let's go." So instead of walking to school like I'd intended, I have to drive my dad's car. He's a better backseat driver than Mom, for sure, but is still well-practiced in white-knuckling it every time the speedometer hops a few. He settles in once we're stopped at a light, takes a breath, and turns to me with the inevitable, "Are you all right?" He doesn't mean my driving, and it doesn't have the same ring to it as Jack's did yesterday. "Fine," I say. I heard my parents arguing last night, and I know they have their own problems right now, but I heard my name thrown about a lot too. Regardless of how they're treating me, I hate to think I'm somehow expanding the rift between them. "Okay," my dad says. "You don't want to talk to me. I get that. But can you cut your mother some slack?" I cross my arms, stupid super long stoplight, and recall when, over the weekend, my mother told everyone I was having delusions. She's never said it quite that way before. Declan hasn't looked at me the same since. And it isn't just the looks, either. It's the texts, the guarded comments, the very way he holds himself. It's all dripping with pity and unease. My dad says, "Your mother scheduled an appointment for you with Mrs. Kramer this afternoon." My therapist. "I don't want to see Sue," I say. "I understand that, but honey, don't you think it would be better for everyone if you at least talked with someone?" "I talk to you." The light turns and I let my foot off the brake too soon. Not that I ram anything, it's just that if my father was offended by my statement, he's too anxious now to show it. Moments later, we pull into the school lot and wait in line behind others who are also either too young or too inexperienced to park. It occurs to me to ask my dad about Bethany's father. "Do you know a Mr. Hammond at the college?" "Only by name," he says. "Our department sent him flowers when his wife died. The poor man. I can't imagine losing both of you. I also can't imagine why you're asking." He catches on quick. I make no comment. "He's a good man, Stella," my dad says. Moment later, he offers up his proof. "He works pro bono at the college. Did you know that? For years now, Dr. Hammond is the one who approached the president about creating a new degree in animal science simply as a favor to the community. He knew we didn't have the funding to pay him." Could be a ruse, a way to get everyone to look the other way while he... I hate that this is my first thought. Must I mistrust everyone? My dad says, "He didn't do this." I put the car in park and let myself out. My dad makes his way around the driver's side, and as he passes me, I can't help but tell him, "They didn't run away, Dad. Thanks for the ride." "Hey!" Declan takes me by the arm between third and fourth period and breaks one of his cardinal rules in doing so. People are watching. "Let me drive you home," he says. "You have practice," I say. "So I'll be late." "No need. I'm headed to the library." "Let me drive you there." "I'll walk," I say, which is what I do now. I walk away from him. "Stella." I stop. I've been short with everyone all weekend, but especially salty with Declan. And it isn't as if I can blame him because I lost the better half of me. As far as I know, no one has any idea still about my crazy dreams, which means the Darbys are keeping their mouths shut. I suppose I should be grateful for that. It's really not fair to Declan, or to my parents, or to anyone who can't wrap their head around my particular way of life. Just because I want them to believe me doesn't make it any easier for them to do so. I turn back, keeping my head down. I say simply, "Thank you anyway," and then speedwalk toward the coffee shop by the police station to meet up with Jack, another reason why I didn't need Declan driving me. I streak across the street when there's a lull in traffic. Inside, Jack is waiting already. He must have just showered because his hair is damp and he smells like shampoo. He smiles when he sees me. My smile back is automatic. "For you," he says, handing me a cup of something hot, "for sustenance." His touch sends ripples through me. "And for courage," he adds, handing me something else. I look down. It's a metal keychain with a saying on it. "If you're going through hell, keep going." Winston Churchill. It's one of the gimmicky gift items they have on display near checkout, but I love it. It nearly rivals Teresa's weapon of choice and is perfect for today. Courage, I repeat, toying with the cool metal. How odd it is that Jack Oliver still feels like a dream. So I read up on your condition, he says. I laugh at that. My condition? Let's call it a superpower. No joke. Studies have shown that an overactive temporoparietal junction is linked to prescience. It's rare, like less than 0.00001% of the population has it, which kind of lends credence to my parallel universe theory. You're not letting that one go, are you? A future Nobel Prize-winning theory? No way. Jack bows his head and smiles. He's adorably shy when he wants to be. I just wanted you to know you're not crazy. You're a visionary. He angles his head toward the street. I figure we do a little braking along with the entering today, if necessary. Did you see the news this morning? No. I draw my head back from the drink. Why? He accesses the news feed, and I see what he means. They finally published a picture of this Hannah girl that was taken last week. She's Anna's age, Jack says. Just about. She doesn't look it. Clearly, she's trying to appear older in the photo, but she's young. Only 12. Did you see anything that night, I ask? Mr. Hammond leaving the house, maybe? No. I mean, I wasn't specifically watching then, but he'd have to drive right past my window, and I'm a light sleeper. These days especially. Jack wraps a hand around the back of his neck in a somewhat nervous gesture. So I did a little more digging on Professor Hammond, on any properties he might have owned in the last several decades. I checked every public record I could find, but if Mr. Hammond has another property, it isn't listed under his name. Right, I say. Thanks for that. Jack tilts his head. Should we go? I'm sick inside. I've only taken a sip, but the latte is spinning circles in my stomach. It's unbelievable that I know who's responsible and it's still happening. He is still taking them. Out on the sidewalk, I hear someone call my name. I ignore it the first time. The second, I turn to find Declan jogging over. I thought you were going to the library, he says. Who's this? I stammer a bit before finally getting the words out. This is Jack, I add. Oliver. Jack's curiosity only gets the best of him for a moment. Technically, he hasn't told me his last name yet. Declan is more than curious. He's mad. I say, he lives near the girl Bethany. One of the ones, and I trail off there. His sister was nearly taken over the weekend. Can I talk to you? Declan says. He's looking at Jack, but clearly speaking to me. He pulls me aside. He's helping me, I say. I was helping you. You couldn't even look at me for 3 full days. I was weirded out, Declan says. When you first told me you were dreaming about these girls, I thought you saw their faces in your sleep. But that's not what this is it? You're acting like you witnessed a murder. I say nothing to that. That's it? You're not speaking to me now? Declan runs both hands through his hair and throws a quick nod in Jack's direction. Is he in them? The dreams? I tell him no, but not quickly enough, because yes, Jack was in them, but no, that's not what this is about. In the end, I repeat myself, despite the lie. No. I explain to Declan about Bethany, how she was planning to run away with her boyfriend, and how her father was trying to prevent that from happening, and still is trying to prevent it. She's not well, I say. She killed her own mother. It was an accident, but still, she admitted it to me last week.
You've talked to her?
Yes. Last week, Declan repeats. Hasn't she been missing for 2? I swallow. I have nothing, no lie, only silence. And it seems Declan is willing to wait me out this time. So I tell him. I was there.
What?
I was one of them. I was taken. And I was trapped, too, until I wasn't anymore. I know it sounds crazy. Believe me, I know. Can't we just try to find the girls?
Declan stares at me wide-eyed for several seconds, comatose, careful. When he finally blinks, he cocks his head toward Jack. Does he know about the dreams, too?
Yes, I told him.
And he believes you.
This time, his glance is accusatory. What was that for?
Come on, Stella. You can't be that naive. Meaning what? I'm angry now, too, knowing exactly what he means. I just want him to say it.
He likes you, Declan says.
We met yesterday. He has a girlfriend.
So?
So he doesn't really believe me. Is that what you're saying?
He's just trying to...
What, Declan? What does he want from me?
Declan shrugs. It's a sorry shrug, the bearer of bad news shrug, the hate to break it to you, but you're such an innocent shrug.
I turn and walk away. He catches up, spins me to face him.
How do you know he's not the guy?
I hate that this makes me pause. I hate even more the pitying look Declan throws at me.
It can't be Jack. That's crazy.
Jack joins us. Hi, he says to Declan and extends a hand. I'm wondering how much he overheard.
Jack Oliver.
When Declan doesn't respond, Jack says, look, we're all after the same thing here. Why don't we go together to pay Mr. Hammond a visit? Strength in numbers, right?
Declan stares at the both of us, working something out in his mind.
His eyes drop to the keychain in my hand and the still attached paper tag, evidence of its newness. He says finally, I have practice. I'll call you later. He leans in for a kiss, but only hovers right in front of my lips, waiting for me to make the final move. I don't. He kisses me on the cheek instead and doesn't look back. For a moment, I stare after him, working something out in my mind. Just because Jack and Bethany live down the street from one another doesn't mean anything. Just because he said he saw nothing the night Bethany was taken, that it was cold, dark, and quiet till morning, and just because Jack was there the night I was taken, too.
It's not him. I know it's not him.
I don't feel well, I say.
Oh, Jack responds. Right. Okay.
He hedges a little, won't meet my eyes.
You should get home.
He looks up briefly to smile.
I'll see ya.
Yeah. While gripping the keychain, I watch him go the way I did Declan, but feel something altogether different. I really hoped he'd argue with me.
Chapter 29. I go the long way home, like the way long way. La Quinta has multiple sidewalks. Sidewalks, bike lanes, and granite sand trails. You see people out walking or biking or riding horses, and they will physically stop and make an about-face at Monroe. Monroe has always been the turnaround point, or point of no return if you see it that way. Monroe is the line of demarcation between what's real and what's not. It's like Mexican food. Real Mexican food isn't what you find at your Chipotle or Baja Fresh. That's Calmex stuff. Not like your Taqueria Tacos. And Teresa's mom's carne asada tacos are legendary from either side of the tracks. Ever since the first resort opened in 1926, La Quinta's always been the souped-up version of the desert. Coachella is the real desert. It's not perfect, but at least it's authentic. Driving down Avenue 52 from Coachella, you don't even have to see the La Quinta city limit sign to know you've arrived, because about the time you hit the Madison Club, home of Billionaires Row, they call it, you can actually see the difference. You can feel it. You breathe easier once you've crossed over from Coachella. Because who wants reality?
I do. Desperately. I miss the imperfect part of me so much I can barely stand it. I'm fully out in the open the entire time, never alone. But it takes me a full hour and a half to get home, and the walk is worth it. I stand at my door and feel the blood pumping, popping even through my veins. My body feels lighter, my burdens lifted. And then I step inside, and a whole slew of people seated throughout our living room turn toward me in unison. I count while naming them. Declan, both of my parents, Declan's mother, and my therapist, Sue. It's only five, but when they're all staring like they are, it feels like an audience. What's going on? I ask, leaving my bag by the front door. No one responds right away. My parents fidget in their seats. Declan is carefully studying the floor. The panic seeps in through my neck, up through my face, throughout my body. He told them. I know it. This is some kind of an intervention.
You missed your appointment today, Sue says.
I had more pressing matters.
The missing girls? She asks.
I try playing it off like I've done so many times before. That was just a dream. But it's too late. I'm sunk here. Why don't you come in here and have a chat with us? Sue says. My mother must sense my desire to bolt. She's up out of her chair and leading me into it. Once I'm seated, she places both hands protectively on my shoulders. It's worse than handcuffs. How could she do this to me, with her own friends watching? Declan says you were there, Sue says, that you claimed to have been one of the missing girls. Does he? I can't even look at him. How can one not have committed a wrong and still burn so with shame? Honey, we're worried about you. Mom, I'm fine. I didn't do anything. No one's being accused here, Sue says. Do you want to talk? It's been a while. No, I do not. I look to my dad, my one available outlet, for help. He responds by clearing his throat. Joanna, don't we have some dinner left over for Stella? I'm not going anywhere until I get answers, my mother says. She moves to the side of the chair, kneels, and speaks in soothing tones to her troubled child. Stella, I thought we were past all this. Can you tell the difference between dreams and reality? Yes, I say, and then only think to myself, sadly, yes, because all that is gone now. I'm no longer dreaming. I want to laugh, for fear I'll cry. The whole situation is so comically unfair in a way that can't possibly get any worse that I decide to level with them all. I look my mother in the eyes, but it doesn't change the fact that I've had these dreams that are leading me to the missing girls. She winces. Of course she does. And the room is quiet. I can hear my own heart beating. What if they're not just dreams? I could ask them, explain about quantum theory and my rarer-than-rare prescience, but is that better or worse? Science fiction versus fantasy. Instead, I say, you could help. I can prove it to you. I'm looking for a barn. An assignment, then, Declan says. I ignore him. He always knew it wasn't an assignment. I think it's up the mountain somewhere. Somewhere near our annual glampout, possibly on BLM land. Not prefabricated, but privately owned, I think. It connects to a house. I have a picture of it in my mind. There are no private residences on protected land, Mom says. Of course there are, Dad says. He's quiet, but he's there. If it predates the establishment. Declan and his mother get up and quietly make their way to the front door. We're finally making headway, and people are leaving? Mom sees them out. None of the rest of us speaks while they go. Declan glances awkwardly back through the crack in the door before it closes on me, and a part of me shatters when it does. For the moment, I've lost my drive. I'm so grateful when my dad speaks up. I looked into your Professor Hammond. The university pulled its funding about the same time he lost his wife. It was bad timing, or good. I don't know that he'd have kept working anyway. I'm not really following. He said university and funding. What university, I ask? What funding? Professor Hammond is a researcher for UC Davis. He used to run the research and extension center for their animal science program out here. You know what an agricultural hub it is. I told you he taught at the college pro bono. And of course he'd have to make his living somewhere. We didn't even think to check Mr. Hammond's name in connection to a different college. My dad says most of his students' training was done on-site at the Extension Center, where there is most certainly a barn. My heart races. Several, probably, he says. Michael, my mother says. She flat-out glares at him. What are you doing? Your professor might even have lived at the facility for a time. Her professor? Sue asks. My dad disappears into the next room and comes back carrying his laptop. He opens it and starts typing. Michael, my mother says again. I did a little research, my dad replies. Where's the harm? You know exactly how harmful this is for her, for all of us. Look, he turns his laptop to show everyone a picture he's found. I will not be made the bad guy here, Mom says. Now, Joanna, Sue begins. And while I get that my intervention has quickly morphed into a couple's therapy session, I can't take my eyes off of the barn on the screen. It's not that I recognize it, because of course I've never seen it from the outside, but the closer I look, the more possibility turns to certainty. The shape of it, the placement of those windows, the type and color of the wood. Where is this? I ask. Exactly where? Chapter 30. I've already changed into long pants and stuffed two granola bars into my pocket. This is unbelievable.
The only digging I did on Mr. Hammond was in connection to his job here at the college. I had no idea he had this whole other life. It's ironically fitting. He took my second life at the same time I discover his. I grab a jacket from the hall closet on my way out the door. You're not going there, my mother says. She hedges my way. I'm not waiting, I tell her. She appeals to her husband next, my father, the hero, whose keys jangle as he slides into his own North Face parka. Michael, please, Mom says. Stella. Mom, I say. He took another girl a few days ago. She's 12. Did you read that in the papers? He hasn't stopped taking them. That's where he is, or at least it's where the girls are. Trust me this once, please. She stands her ground, but her eyes tear up. She'd never cry in front of me. It just wouldn't happen. Sue went home when we all decided to switch venues. She and Mom were deep in whispered conversation at the front door for some time before she left. My therapist gave my mother a hug while I watched. Here I stand with the cold air blowing in, and my own mother acting as captain of the guard. No hugs for me, just mistrust. My only comfort is knowing that what I tell her is true. I'm not crazy, I say. She only blinks. My dad comes between us. He takes a breath. Whatever we find there tonight, honey, I don't think you coming is a good idea. It takes me a second to realize he's talking to me. What? No, you're not going alone. He angles his head out the door. I've called someone down at the station. And only then does my mother step aside. Dad, please, you won't know if it's the right place. I have to see it for myself. I'm begging now. I'll stay in the car. In the end, my mother only relents when she decides to go too. We have to wait another 15 minutes for her to get ready, and by then our police escort has been waiting for 5. It's a quiet drive. We follow a navy blue sedan up State Route 74, just another happy family out to secure a camping site for the night. Except that we're not spending the night, and nobody's happy. Not a week has passed since we were last up this way, but it's felt like a lot longer than that to the girls trapped in a barn. I wish we'd gotten to them sooner. The car in front of us has no emergency vehicle lighting, no indication whatsoever that it's with the police force. It looks like the car version of the tall cop from the station, and I can't help wondering if that's who's driving. It kind of bothers me they only sent one car. They obviously don't believe us. I can imagine how that conversation went. No, really, it's likely nothing. You remember the girl from the other day? Delusions, right. I won't be late. The nearer we get, the thicker the trees, the harder it is to breathe. I'm actually afraid for my dad. My mom, too. But she's as likely to get out of the car as I am. We veer off the road a little past the Kaweah Reservation, but before Lake Hemet. We climb up a dirt road a ways when the unmarked sedan in front of us kills its lights. Dad follows suit. We pass a sign indicating we've arrived at the University Research and Extension Center. I stop breathing altogether, and we ease slowly into a clearing. It's a whole facility, like my dad said, not just the barn and the one home like I thought. There are lots of little homes, sheds, pens for cows, all sorts of things. It's an entire operation gone dead, like a little ghost town, a thought that makes me shiver. Are there ghosts in this town? And where are the bodies buried? We're moving at a snail's pace now. It's dark out for one. The moon lights the way enough that we can at least follow this dirt path that we're on. Then, just when it seems we've made our way through to the end of the road, we turn a corner and go up a little rise, and there the barn is, looming large, bigger than I would have thought it. Creepier, too, standing in shadow. No street lamps up here either. The sedan stops, and then so do we. My heart leaps into a sprint. I grip the handle of the door with both hands. I can't help the tears that spring to the corners of my eyes. I blink them away. The policemen, at least there are two of them, step out of the sedan in no real hurry. I don't recognize either one, and both are in full uniform. At least there's that. When my dad opens the driver's side door, one of the cops makes a motion for him to stay put, right before he tilts his head and says something into the radio on his shoulder. I crack the window, but I've already missed whatever it was he said. I do pick up a distant whining sound, though I can't tell from what or where. It could be an electrical box, like wiring for all these buildings, I don't know. The two policemen walk quietly and without lights around the barn in opposite directions. They meet back at the car to consult. Again, it's too quiet to hear.
And now the flashlights come on. The windows are higher up, like I remember them being, but there's a rooftop access ladder with rungs near enough to a couple of them that one of the policemen makes use of. He climbs up and shines the light inside the nearest window. I'm fogging up my own window with my breath, trying to see what he sees, hoping the girls inside see him too, and all the while praying that Mr. Hammond has chosen to stay at home with his shotgun tonight. The policeman climbs down. The two follow one another to the trunk of the sedan and take out what looks like a toolkit. They walk it around the side of the building where I can't see, where the only door would be, and I hear a definitive crunch, like metal on metal, and then chain coming loose and falling to the ground. And that's it. I can't just sit here anymore. I tug on the handle of the car door and find it's locked. My dad says, "No, Stella," like I'm a child again. It feels like an eternity before they're back outside, and my heart plummets to see no one with them. The cop, same from before, motions to my father to step outside. Dad leans over the seat to tell me, "You stay here." Another eternity passes while Mom picks silently at her fingernails. It's a habit she only engages in when she's stressed. All three men walk into and then out of the barn together, conversing. They're done here, as evidenced by the one cop closing the barn doors. They're not even going to let me inside. I pull up the lock, throw open the door, and sprint around the three of them, busting my way into the barn that looks, smells, even tastes the way I remember it. I'd collapse to my knees, but they're on my heels, and I can't let us go without at least showing them the trap door. Ignoring my dad's protests, I jet over to the most easterly pen. Something's not right. There's no chicken wire, for one. Not on any of them. The pen makes no squeaking sound as I open it up, and there's the trap door, just where it should be. I'm nearly sick on it. But where's Bethany's rug? The pile of hay that was her mattress? Her book? Where's the food? Policemen catch up with me. "It's through there," I tell them, pointing. "There's an underground passage." "We looked," says the one. "But you had to have missed something. They were here." "Miss," says the other, "the house is empty. There isn't any sign of anyone having lived either here or there for a very long time." My head is spinning. My dad leads me out of the stall. I can see my mother's figure, backlit by the moon, waiting at the entrance to the barn. This is so not the way things should have gone tonight. We were supposed to free the missing girls, catch us a killer. I was supposed to be validated at last. My legs buckle, and my dad moves to catch me before I fall. That's when a bright light powers on from the outside, shining like the sun directly on my mother's backlit figure. I hear, unmistakably, the cocking of a shotgun.